The aim of the spiritual quest of the Buddha is not to learn to meditate the spiritual path in the Buddhist tradition or in any tradition for the matter to the practice of meditation. And sometimes we have the tendency to see the practice of meditation really as the most important or the only thing that matter in the spiritual quest or in the spiritual path. And I think that is unwise. We can describe the spiritual path in a general way according to three types of practice. Could be divided in many ways, sometimes in the Eightfold Path, but here tonight I like to speak about three ways of describing the spiritual path. So the first one is generosity, second one is morality, and the third one is meditation. So those three aspects include all the various aspects of the spiritual path. And they have something in common. There's something in common in generosity, in morality, and meditation. And it is letting go. The essence of those three types of practice is letting go. And we'll see that the letting go in those three fields expressed slightly differently, yet it is still a letting go. In one of the sutra, it is said that one is including the two others. So we may wonder which one includes the two other, generosity, morality, and meditation. And we may believe that it is meditation, but the text says generosity include the two other aspects of the path. And I think it's quite interesting to see meditation as generosity. I think it's interesting to see it from this perspective. So letting go. And that, of course, goes in the sense of freedom, since freedom is from, the bondage is from holding on to various aspects of our confusion. When we let go of aspect of our confusion, when we let go of the attitude that is binding us, then we may discover freedom. I know, maybe we should say more about what freedom means, because we speak about freedom like if it was clear. But for the time being, let's imagine the freedom as I have expressed the other day, freedom from desire, aversion, and confusion. When there is no confusion, then there is one is not conditioned by one's own imagination. So the letting go in generosity is a letting go of attachment. The letting go in morality is the letting go of the wish to harm other people. And the letting go in meditation is the letting go of confusion. So with respect to generosity, we may imagine first that generosity is about making another person happy. That may be the motivation to make another person happy. That is a kindness, that is metta that you have been practicing. But the act of generosity is a letting go of attachment. And I think that's quite wise to see it in this way. So if one were to give to somebody else something that one does not want anymore, one will never say, oh, that is so generous of you to get rid of that stuff that you don't want anymore. And we know that very well, that is not really a deep generosity when one get away with something that one does not want anymore. But when it really is something that we care for, that in a sense we like, and then we let go of it, then that's an act of generosity. And we can see also in this sense how there is in this action a letting go of something, of the attachment, the letting go of holding on to something. And we may even feel how that brings some kind of freedom. How when we believe that we possess many things, maybe it is rather that we are possessed by those things. If we think about example, it is quite interesting to see people that do possess very little, how in some sense there is a sense of freedom. I mean, those who choose, not those who do not possess much and dream about possessing very much. This is another story. But I mean those who choose. I remember in India meeting a sadhu near a small town. I was with a few friends, and so we sat by him and maybe drank tea, and it was very interesting. He spoke quite nicely English, and saying that he said he was much more free because we were born with all those stuff that we had, and he had hardly anything, and we could feel the freedom. It was not just a way of speaking. He had nothing, small clothes and maybe a ball like that, and that was enough for him. Next day he would walk and go to a village, get some food and sit by a tree and make a small fire, make some tea, and that will be it. And I think we sense when we meet people that they have chosen a simple way of life like that, that there is some freedom, some lightness that we may lack when we are burdened with all our possession. Imagine that if, like the sadhu, we were to carry along with ourselves all our belonging. Can you imagine to go from the tea shop to the road? You know, it will take ages. You know? So, in this sense, we can feel how the letting go is in the sense of more freedom. And we are challenged in that in daily life, and it's a beautiful way to practice and also a way to realize how advanced we are in our spiritual path. In meditation, we may always wonder, is it so deep, my meditation? Is it clear? I am really nearly awakened or something like that. One can ask a nice question like that. But with respect to generosity and the way we behave in daily life, this is usually quite clear. There's not so much doubt. It is about an action, and we see our type of behavior. In Geneva, in Paris, in other city, I don't know if there are many beggars in Tel Aviv, but or Jerusalem, but there are certainly a lot in Paris and in Switzerland, in Geneva. It's always interesting to see how people connect with the beggars in the street. Many ways. Some people that suddenly need to look on the other side of the sidewalk when they come. They did not see this beggar. You know, that's one way of dealing. Some just walk looking straight ahead and don't see. Some other look at them with some kind of, bad feeling. You know, what are you doing here? And some, luckily, hopefully, some are more open and give to the beggars. Or some, say, we cannot give to everyone. You know? That seems to be such a good argument. We cannot give to everyone, therefore they give to no one, because we cannot give to everyone. This way and I think there is something very special in the meeting of a beggar, because there is, of course, no obligation to give. So it's something very free. And the people begging, they know that very well. So when one is giving to a beggar, it's an act of freedom, and it's also the meeting of two human beings. And I notice so many times that it is very rare to meet a human being as deeply as when you meet a beggar. If one goes to buy something in a store, of course you need to pay. It's not because of your kindness suddenly that you go and pay for what you had. So the salesman or saleswoman here, they are not thanking you so much because you are paying for what you get, There is some kind of a mechanical aspect in the relationship most of the time. But with respect to the contact with the beggar, it's something very different. There's no obligation there. It's completely free that one chooses to give and the other person receiving. And as a writer, Buddhist writer, I think second century, wrote that in order for an act of generosity to happen, you need a beggar and somebody that give to the beggar. And he said, the most difficult job is for the beggar, is not the one who gives. So one should be thankful for the beggar to do the hard part of the job, to stay all the day by the road, you know, but just go by. So it's kind of interesting way of seeing that, believing, I'm so good I can choose, you know, but the other person has a difficult job in that. So in this sense, it's always a very interesting exploration, the meeting with people soliciting, like in the street. Always interesting to see one's reaction, the way one relate to people. And there are ways, in a sense, to avoid this meeting. You know, like the person looking on the other side is even not honest to decide, I will not give. So not taking the responsibility of not giving is a very, very poor way of choosing. You know, I don't want to take the responsibility for saying no, therefore I pretend I have not seen. It's quite interesting way of dealing with the situation. There are ways to avoid the situation by, for example, reducing the other to categories. You know? So you don't meet a person, you meet a category. You meet a drug addict, a drunker, or whatever. In Europe now they meet people from gypsy, you know, category, because they are a lot begging. So they put them in category. Therefore you don't deal with a human being, we deal with a category. And it's like a screen that prevent you from meeting one person. It's never a category of person that you meet. It's always one person. And I read a book written by a psychiatrist in Paris that spent 3 weeks in the street with homeless people. And he said that usually people pretend not to give because they will go and drink. You know? He said it's true, but they are in such a poor state usually that anyway they need to drink. It's not a state where you could give them a moral speech and say, please don't drink. He said it's much too late. You know? So he said usually people, because they drink, they end up in the street. And if they're in the street, in order to face it, they start to drink. So most of them are drunk. So this kind of very easy moralistic way to say, no, they're going to drink. You know? Again, a way to avoid. Or it can also just be said by saying hi. It doesn't mean that it's an obligation to give. You know? Just recognizing the other person as a human being. Simone Weil was really written beautiful text about that. He said, as soon as we recognize the other person as a full human being, everything is done. Everything then follow naturally. So that the main work is to recognize in the other a full human being. And then naturally what need to be done will be done. So maybe giving, maybe not giving. At time it is skillful or wise not to give. Here I'm speaking about giving a little amount of money, but one also is challenged to give one's time, one's competence, a lot of things, and that one can see how one can hold to one's own time, one's own comfort, you know, and I don't want to let go of that. I was giving a retreat recently and we needed people to ring the bell every day. It was funny how difficult it was to find people. People want to protect their practice, so I don't want to ring the bell, because then I just need to be aware of the time and go and ring the bell. So in order to protect their practice, they were holding on, not seeing that the letting go of that comfort will be in the sense of more freedom. They were bound, they were not free. Not free to give their time, because they were holding on to their comfort. I remember once at a retreat, at the end, we needed to clean the place, and it was hard to find anybody to clean the place. And my first reaction was, I needed to go actually, I needed to take a train and to move on. And I could see that my holding on to my comfort was not allowing me to decide to help. And I did not like this lack of freedoms, and I let go of this comfort, and I could see I was free to choose, and okay, I can help. What did disturb me was I was not free to decide because I was holding on to something. So we can explore in many situations in our daily life. Where is freedom? Where is bondage? And how holding on is really make our world much narrower. So the practice of generosity goes really is an important practice in the spiritual path. It's not, as we could imagine sometimes in the text, it was the main practice of the lay people because they needed to support the monastic community. But that's not just a second-hand practice. It is a very important practice. In the Tibetan tradition, there is a story where a great master is questioning two of his main disciples. One is a great scholar, the other is a great meditator, and he wonder about their spiritual achievement. So he asked the first one, the scholar, and then he asked the meditator, and he's not so amazed by their achievement. And then he asked the servant. One monk was serving the tea. And then he see that the servant was much more free, was much more achieving his spiritual path than the scholar and the meditators. So that we believe often that technicity of meditation is what is all about the spiritual path, but far from that. Although it does help, it does bring light and wisdom, that is true. But if we forget the other aspect of the spiritual path, then it can be very cut from life, and then does not bring any freedom in our daily life, which is what matters. So that the practice of generosity now, there is one aspect in the practice of generosity which I think is important, is that, as I said, there is no obligation, is a free act. But if we believe that we are going to receive benefit from it, like sometimes in Asia it said, you accumulate merit and then you will be rich in another life, so it's better to be generous so you'll be rich in another life. I think it's a very materialistic way of seeing the practice of generosity. So now I practice, it's like being smart, like in a bank, I put my money here, therefore more will come next life. You know? And that take away some of the freedom of just giving for no reason, being completely free. And this is a very important dimension. If one were to give to a beggar because of obligation, because the tradition say you should give, because my father said I should give, or because I feel there's some profit, you know, somebody is taking my picture when I'm giving, or whatever. So, it will certainly take away a lot of the value, and the beggar will not be mistaken in that. The person receiving would see immediately that there is something quite wrong in our relationship. It's just, he's there as a pretext. I'm using him, so to speak. He gets some benefit, hopefully get some money or whatever, but he's not respected. He's being used in this case. And when there is no benefit whatsoever that we expect, we dream about, there is something that is just this meeting of two human beings. So I think the fact that we do not expect benefit from that, I think it's quite important and much richer than if we believe that it is a way to be richer later in the future, which I think is not really amazing. Then there is nothing very much moral or generous about it. If you give in order the banker never believed that the people to come and put the money in the bank are generous with the bank. You know, it's so generous of you to come and put the money, you know, in this case. So I think it's quite important to see as an act that does not give some benefit, but is completely free, but it's also an expression of freedom in the letting go of the attachment. Now, with respect to morality, the letting go of the wish to harm. Again, this is very, very interesting. It's not, sometimes we believe morality is just the fact that of not doing anything wrong, but it's not that in the Buddhist tradition. It's not doing anything wrong. If, let's say, if you are alone in a cave, then in a sense there is very little opportunity to practice morality, because you could always go and stamp on ants or something like that, but otherwise there is no wish to harm other that you can let go of. It is said in the text that the Buddha does not practice morality, neither do the great disciple, because there is no impulsion to harm other, therefore there can be no letting go of that. So there is no practicing morality. And I think that's an important aspect. We see morality as a letting go of the intention to harm, because often we may feel guilty. I have negative intention with respect to another person. I feel guilty. That is not so helpful, but if I can let go of that, then I see that is really the practice of morality and also bring more freedom. I want to harm another person, whatever, with words or so many means we can use, and then I let go of that, and I feel the freedom that there is in that. In so many ways, just speaking badly about other person, the resentment, or in a sense also the guilt feeling, you know, guilt feeling is this resentment against ourselves, the wish to harm ourselves. Can I let go of that? And we can see there is a lot of freedom in that. So seeing the opportunity to practice morality, again, not as a guilt feeling because I have negative intention, but exploring if when I let go of them, how much freedom is gained by that. Again, not because I would follow some rules. The Buddhist tradition speaks about 10 virtuous actions or 10 non-virtuous actions to be avoided, but it's like just to remember, it's not a set of law that one has to follow. Because there is no one in the Buddhist tradition to have the authority to give the law, do and don't. This is not possible. We'll see the dimension of that a bit later. So the letting go of the intention to harm another person. I think one of the strongest examples that I have in mind is when in the US, in the freedom fight for black people, when some people burn a church, in Birmingham, a black church, and four little girls were died in this burning of the church, Martin Luther King, with very much power, really restrained all the black community of fighting back. And there's something there which is not weakness, on the contrary, which is very strong, and so strong that he was able to hold all the black community not to fight back, not to arm, for the instant there, to arm the other, the white people that had done that. Was not only morally true, but it was also wise, because the power, of course, were on the other side. So that is, I think, a strong example of seeing the letting go of the wish to harm that bring freedom. And I see also it has a lot of wisdom in that. And it is said in the Dhammapada, hatred only ends by the letting go of hatred, not by more hatred. Dhammapada, any text can say that. We don't need to go to the Orient to find such a statement. I think it's a very common wisdom. So letting go, again, as a means of freedom. Then the third one, I will come back on morality a bit later, but the third one is meditation as a letting go of confusion. Now in meditation, usually there are two ways to meditate. One is samatha and the other is vipassana. Samatha is a tranquilization of the mind, bringing some stability in the mind, some concentration, which is a skillful way to train the mind. And the other is vipassana. Vipassana means to see more clearly. Vi means like a sharp or cutting through, and the root of paspasyana means to see through, and that the development of wisdom. Samatha, the tranquility, is for the sake of vipassana, is there to help to go deeper in vipassana or in sharper way, but within itself, the practice of calmness or concentration has not this power to cut through confusion. So if we speak about the meditation in the sense of vipassana as we are doing it here, the letting go of confusion is exactly what we are exploring every instant of our practice. So which type of confusion? The confusion is, or the way we can hold on to anything is through concept. The bondage in which we are, if you like, the jail, is made of our imagination, not of reality. We are bound by our imagination, by our confusion, not by reality. And that's quite important. If we believe we are bound, limited by reality, then that's it. There's nothing that can be done. But when we start to consider or realize that we are bound by our imagination, by our confusion, as we are responsible for our own bondage, then we can be responsible for our own freedom. If there would be somebody else responsible for our bondage, this person will have the key to our freedom. The person who holds the key to bondage holds the key to freedom. So it's quite interesting, because we are binding ourselves, we can free ourselves. If it were not the case, we could not free ourselves. So this way confusion works is that any experience, we translate that into, transform that into a concept. We hold that through a concept of the simple experience, or sometimes concept of value, of comparison. And in the meditation, we learn to be so intimate with the experience that we are there in the experience before the process of evaluation, of conceptualization arise. There's a innocence, if you like, in the experience before we create a world from this experiencing. So that is a letting go of conceptualization that we are projecting on each experience. In one sutra, one monk come and ask the Buddha, I said, tell me, sir, where is the freedom when one is lost in the sea of torment, of lamentation, of suffering? Where is freedom? So he says, where is the island? Where is the freedom? The refuge. And the Buddha said, the refuge and the island, which mean awakening, which mean nirvana, the island and the refuge, when one is lost in the sea of lamentation, torment and confusion, is in not grasping. See, very clearly, is in not grasping. So not grasping is a way to be in the world quite different than when one is lost in evaluation. It's not that the conceptualization is bad in itself, but when we take it to be the truth, then we are binding ourselves. So this letting go is coming not because we try to throw away, something is arising and we want to throw away. That is not a letting go, that is still a grasping. But because we are trying to be as intimate, as sensitive to the experience, sensory experience, mental experience, the emotion which were to be very intimate before there is any conceptualization, or seeing through the conceptualization as not reality, but as being just conceptualization. And then we can free ourselves from this grasping and from confusion. And when there is no confusion, there is no desire, aversion, no confusion, then there is freedom. So all the three aspects work exactly in the same sense of letting go. And it's something very similar in the attitude in the three cases. Now this way of seeing the spiritual path, maybe there is something slightly lacking that maybe the later Buddhist tradition will describe and take in account, is maybe a sense of engagement in the world. We see this giving is certainly an engagement, but the morality is seen as not wanting to harm others. That's fine, but where the engagement in a sense with the world? And I think the later tradition, what we call the Mahayana tradition, was aware of that and developed, an understanding of morality maybe a little bit vaster than the one I just described. And as I just mentioned, that morality is not a set of rules that one needs to follow. That's not the case in the Buddhist tradition. That there is no authority to tell the do and don't. Everyone is sent to their own responsibility. In one sutra, some people went to ask the Buddha who they should trust. I've spoken about this sutra the other night. Who they should trust, because they were meeting so many great teachers that came in their village and spoke with so much certainty that they all held the truth. So the village asked the Buddha, but how can we trust someone? And the Buddha tell them that they should not trust somebody because he's well known, because he's intelligent, good-looking, because he used all his scriptures, or not saying it is our beloved teacher. He said, you have to see by yourself, and then only if you see by yourself, that is, that you can understand and see by yourself, that then you should practice. There's another account in the sutras where at the time of the death of the great disciple of the Buddha, Sariputra, the novice monk that was helping Sariputra came carrying the bowl and the robe of Sariputra. So when Ananda, the servant of the Buddha, saw that, he understood immediately that it meant that Sariputra had died. So they went to the Buddha to report that Sariputra had died. And Ananda was very sad and disheartened because Sariputra was his own teacher. It's very interesting. Ananda was a servant of the Buddha, always with him, but the person that was guiding him in his spiritual practice was Sariputra. So now he felt lost because his teacher had gone and died. So we imagine a very easy solution. The Buddha can say, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you. But that's not what the Buddha said. Buddha says, Sariputra has not taken anything with him that you need. He said, be a light to yourself, be a refuge to yourself, be an island to yourself. He said, just trust yourself. It's quite amazing. It's just there, by the side of the Buddha, every day, every night. But trust yourself. And this sense of responsibility is quite demanding, actually. It's in many sense easier to follow a set of rules rather than to have to trust oneself. So in the practice of morality, there's also this dimension of not having a set of rules that is easy to follow, but to have to choose. We have the freedom and the necessity to choose every instant what to do, how to do it. not because somebody said we should do in one way, and not because we'll get some benefit, and that will be some kind of materialistic way of seeing morality, we choose because it's expression of freedom. But often we don't want to choose, so we find excuse or we pretend that we have no choice. Like when we look away from the beggar, so we don't choose not to give. Oh, I'm sorry, I did not see. But there is a choice. I did first. I choose to look away. So I can pretend that I did not choose not to give, but I choose to look away. And in any choice that we are taking, we are creating, is not just my decision of looking away. When I choose to do that, it's also the world in which I'm living that I'm creating. It means that for me, I'm creating at this time a world where people seeing somebody difficulty look away. That the world in which I'm living, that the world I'm creating. So any choice that we do in any situation is also linked with the responsibility of the world we are creating. But as it is quite kind of great responsibility to have this choice and freedom, then very often we pretend not to have freedom. We escape the taking of responsibility. Because it's difficult. I have no choice. Or wrong reasoning. We cannot give to everyone. Now, I hide my decision not to give behind a very poor reasoning. We cannot give to everyone. So there's so many ways that we escape our responsibility. So in a sense, there is less belief in tradition to recognize the authority of tradition in the 21st century. Therefore, less belief in guideline, you should do this way or that way. That may be okay. But then, there is also maybe not yet the responsibility of really being up to the choice and choosing and taking the responsibility for one's choice. Or maybe in a situation where people like to speak about freedom but not about responsibility. How we miss seeing that any choice we do, it's also a decision about the world in which we like to live. It's not limited to our own small action. It does decide, choose the world in which I'm living. And what I find quite striking in the Buddhist tradition is this sense of freedom and responsibility that each one of us has to choose and to take the responsibility for one's choice. Not escaping into because I will have further benefit. If I behave properly, I will have further benefit. I think this is, in a sense, a poor way to go around, to try to convince myself because I will have further benefit, therefore I should behave properly. This is, I think, poor reasoning. But I behave in certain way, I make some choice. Because it is the expression of the world in which I choose to live. So this is quite a great responsibility. So if we imagine every day and every choice we make, if that was deciding in a general way the world in which we are living, then we start to be quite careful about what we choose. So I think in the later Buddhist tradition, there is more this sense of responsibility and engagement in one's activity, rather than just the letting go of the wish to harm, but really seeing the responsibility of the the world that we're creating through our choice. It's something quite striking to be left with this freedom to choose without any obligation. And yet to try to take the responsibility for the choice we make. That really, really asks much maturity from each one of us. Okay, so I'd like to finish with a few minutes in silence.